and we are affected by different things, a part of the Mahatattva, especially to the degree that we are not holding deep to internal protection. So, some of you may are probably experiencing a lot of challenges and having to deal with a lot of sort of reflections in your own life, and you should know that you're not alone, that it is it's out there and it's happening. And it's exciting because it's a wonderful chance to literally to allow the science of spiritual life of Krishna consciousness to work more for you. But it's also a time that where we are weak, we're really going to know it. And so often we're not so honest, and we're weak in areas and ways that we're not really admitting so much. Or often we are kind of minimizing how intense that maya is. Or some of you may be directly behind Sadhacharya. Perhaps you want to move over so you won't just be seeing his back. You know, he's going to be in your front. Judge, maybe you want to come over some more? Brother Leo. So, these incredible times that the planet is undergoing, what people are having to deal with, it's kind of embarrassing because the tendency in material life is that we are highly subjected to illusion, to our senses, and we're very much influenced by duality. And so, as so much of the material duality is existing, then if we are not so grounded, then we'll be more affected by it. You know, just like in lifting weights, if you train nicely, heavy weights, you lift them, and it shows that you have the endurance and the strength. And not if you try to pick them up, you hurt your back, or you fall down with it, or so many things. So we see a lot of people getting setbacks because in lifting weights, it means, yeah, weights, and it gets heavier and heavier, and you lift, and you become more successful as you lift greater quantities. And we, of course, pray and hope that more people will take advantage of these wonderful times. But if not, that's also good, because when we have to look at ourselves dealing with these issues or see that we can't lift so much, then it means, okay, we have to prepare better. We have to strengthen ourselves. We have to look a little closer, especially through the shastra, to see where we're lacking in such a way. So Krishna is very kind, and Krishna gives us so many opportunities to be able to grow, so many opportunities to be able to know, you know, what is to be done, and of course how to do it. And that is the whole science, the whole science of bhakti. So now, in that spirit, especially a couple of people asked me a little more than usual. They're asking me a question like, "How do you go on year after year in your spiritual life? How do you get around some of the issues?" Or, in other words, basic thing was, "How are you avoiding being less disturbed?" Or whatever. First thing is that I am disturbed. And the second thing is that spiritual life is not easy for me. Every day is a challenge and a struggle. We see often that, we said after 20, 30 years, it's sometimes people having to do total regrouping in their spiritual life. And that's good, that's healthy, but it's also dangerous. And it gives a person a chance to look and to see, what have they really accepted? To what degree have they began to become a distinct part of spiritual culture? Or what degree is it still something that we ponder upon and read about and speak about but don't really so much believe? To what degree has it really become a part of us and accepted in our hearts? So, first sometimes I tell them that everyone is struggling in different ways in our conditioned state, and at the same time Krishna is helping everybody. It has no favors. We bring in different things according to our past life. We bring in certain credits and according to our heredity and environment and our secrecy. I mean, there are different things happen. But still, each person is being given tests according to their situation and their needs and their stagnation. But I do constant inventory almost daily, but sometimes I do very distinct monthly inventory, yearly, and even by decade. So last couple of days, since I didn't have to travel for a while, I was doing some inventory like by decades, looking 10 years back and reflecting. And I was also thinking, yeah, there are certain things that people do, different people do, to help them to be more balanced. Like the other day, Mahamaya from India, long-time devotee of the movement, joined almost 30 years ago, senior disciple of Srila Prabhupada. And so she was explaining, giving her some of her pastimes of Srila Prabhupada, her realizations, and it was quite interesting. And at one point she mentioned how she had never, ever, even one day, missed chanting her rounds. And so, of course, some of us, I'm sure, were thinking, oh, this is some of her shakti, her strength. This is how it's working for her. That she is letting the process work for her because she has been very loyal in various ways, and this is a sign. And so along with that loyalty of commitment, then certain protection, certain realization, are concomitant or go along with such. And as we go on and on from day to day as spiritualists, then we want to look and see how can we make this work more in our lives. But we look at people who seem to be working better, and we think and look, what are they doing that I'm not doing? Everyone can become more and more Krishna conscious. Everyone can become more and more absorbed in God consciousness. So what is someone doing that I'm not doing? Or what is someone doing that I also can do? Another way of reflecting is, people are going to become God conscious in this lifetime. And I want to be one of those persons. We can evaluate, think about it that way too. Somebody is going to become God conscious. Okay, I want to be one of those persons, unequivocally, who's going to become God conscious. It's possible. Supreme Lord is fair. He's not made it so difficult that no one can become. Therefore, I'm going to become God conscious. So what do I have to do? And how can I speed up the process? So, as I was looking back, some decades, not this decade, but previous decades, for many years I would write diary notes. And in those diary notes I would literally write, today I die. Today is the last day of my life. And I would start it off like that and then make my submissions to my spiritual master, spiritual mentor, Srila Prabhupada, and then look at what I'm anticipating doing. The few moments or the few hours that I have before perhaps I have to die. And so this was an effort to try to take each day in the spirit of, if this is your last day, how are you going to end your existence on this planet? If this is the last opportunity you have in relating to certain people and doing certain things, what is going to be your status in completion? As we know, at the time of death, according to our consciousness, determines what our next life is going to be. And so any kind of austerity, any kind of regimentation can become also mechanical, and we can lose the potency of that. So then I saw, sometime later, I was writing, trying to pretend, because it's pretension, but trying to write in the spirit of Vasudev Datta, or Lord Jesus, in the sense of Let me suffer for other people and let them be okay. And so we go on and on and on, and right, basically in that type of mentality. And so I was just reflecting, because I was thinking, yes, I do feel very happy in my spiritual life. Externally, I'm, you know, having more sickness and all kind of stuff. But internally, I feel literally extremely happy. In one sense, I feel each year more Krishna conscious. Let's hope that it's not just a matter of an illusion. But I feel more excited about Krishna consciousness. I feel more excited about what Prabhupada has given. I feel more positive about the uniqueness of our connection with Radha Krishna. And the more that I study other religions, philosophies, cultures, the more I become excited, that much more excited about what we have. Sometimes devotees have more trouble, because sometimes our credits may not be so much, and we only are in looking at what we have, and then we have some problem, we lose it because we minimize, take for granted what we actually have. Just like there are certain problems that you have in community, certain problems you have in the monastic orders and celibacy, certain problems you have where there is strict regimentation, rules and regulations, and they're just natural things. There are certain institutional problems that happen, you know, in phases and cycles. And so, often people who are only thinking that it's happening to them, or to their community, or to their religion, it becomes more difficult when they do have to deal with problems. Because the other side is people who involve themselves in so many things superficially that they never really access a deeper consciousness, because they don't get deep in anything. So in some ways there's a shortcoming in only knowing our theology. In some ways there's a shortcoming. Because then one can become a fundamentalist, but also one can become very dedicated, but then we have deeper challenges, an individual may have a problem. So it's important to know our legacy. We look and we see there are certain types of issues that we have as Vaishnavas, certain types of issues that people have in spiritual on spiritual journey. Just as earlier today I was reading about the different types of pseudo-sampradaya. And there's about 13 major, you know, ones, but there's sometimes considered over 50 or 60 that are going on just in connection with different sort of offshoots of Mahaprabhu's own mission. There's all kind of bowls, all kind of, and when Bhakti Vinod was on the planet, he was particularly addressing 13 or so major ones. But there's all kind of even offshoots of those. And we see there are various scriptures that explain what happens when spiritual authority, when gurus fall down. So there are issues that are not just something that's a part of ISKCON or a part of just this modern day presentation of Vaishnavism. There's certain issues that are not just a part of those who are trying to pursue personal understanding of God, but there's certain things that are there in religion in general. There's certain things that are there in transcendence, and there's certain things that's a part of our immediate heritage or legacy. And as we understand those things better, we realize, oh, this is all part of the process of growth, of maturation. This is a part of this level of consciousness, is some of the things that are associated with certain other level of consciousness. And we go on without losing any serious sleep. But now I've been writing this new book, Beggar 3, where the whole book is emphasizing addressing the false ego. Because one of the real difficult issues for any spiritual people is false ego. Then these people who are connected with some bona fide spiritual process, then a serious issue has to deal with really trying to understand the authentic self. In contrast to all the acculturation due to one trying to engage in sense gratification, different ways, gross and subtle. And so the gross is there, but more difficult for spiritualists who are trying to be serious is the subtle. And that's where most people are an embarrassment and fall down again and again and again. Because until we understand how serious and how powerful the false self is, and we see through the great writings of the Acharyas, they constantly address it like it's a different person, because it's like having a different entity within you that's knowing your greatest weaknesses and constantly keeps jumping out. So sometime back, I was trying to be more serious. And so I was trying to get some understanding, approach to Prabhupada, about some understanding how to be a better devotee. Often you hear me use the terminology to be submissive, humble, and bold. As I was looking back through notes, and I got the exact wordage of Prabhupada to give me, and that was selfless, being selfless, humble, and brave. So the other day, and I was doing some writing, I went over to the cabin, and I wrote a new meditation, capitalizing off that transmission from Srila Prabhupada. Selfless, humble, and brave, as a way to try to address false ego, and as a way to look at certain spiritual technologies in resolving problems. So we call this being selfless, humble, and brave. Many people die very young. I wrote this also in the mindset of what I was doing a decade ago, and thinking, and writing, reading Srila Prabhupada, and then writing, today is the last day of my life. And then reflecting about what I'm going to do that day, I'm going to do it in that spirit that this is the last day that I'm going to live. So whatever is important, let's do it now. Whatever offenses I've made, I have to clear them up now. Whatever grudges I'm holding, I have to address it now. Whatever phobias I'm taking shelter of, I must look at those now. Whatever offerings I must make, I must do those now. Now, this is not a morbid mentality, but a mentality of recognizing that we all have to leave. And we're definitely going to give up this body. It doesn't matter how intelligent we are. Doesn't matter how much wealth we have. Doesn't matter how much fame we have. Doesn't matter how much we've accomplished. None of that makes the difference that everyone is going to have to go. And we all know that. But we have to ask ourselves, to what degree do we really accept it? To what degree do we actually base our life that, yes, we have to plan, but what degree do we really base our life that every plan that we have, it may mean nothing tomorrow. It may mean nothing next week or 10 years from now, or 15, 20, whatever. But even tomorrow, it may mean nothing. So many people died this morning who had no idea that they were going to leave. They had so many plans of making money, of doing this, of doing that, of going this place, going that place, connecting with this person, that person. And now all of that means nothing. So, addressing false ego, considering that whatever success, failures, grief, whatever is there, that it can mean nothing tomorrow. Because we may have to put it all behind us. So, as you hear me share this with you, keep those things in mind. First thing is, false ego is awesome. And the more we try to be serious, the more the false ego has to be addressed. And the more that we address it, the more we become transcendentalists rather than religionists. Because as religionists, we're still demanding something from God and thinking mainly how to have the obstacles of our material interferences removed. So we are entering spiritual life still because we're really just trying to enjoy temporary things. And how much are we ready to move outside of the duality? So the false ego will keep jumping up to give us a chance to look close. Of to what degree are we really grounded in bodily and mental consciousness rather than spiritual consciousness? The other thing is about death. We hear it, we know it, we understand it somewhat, we talk about it. But now, bring it home. If I have to leave tomorrow, what does that mean for my husband, for my wife, for my children? What does that mean for my debts? What does that mean for my plans? What will that really mean for me? We have to ask ourselves. And the other thing is my personal sharing of Prabhupada. You mentioned to me once about being selfless, humble, and brave. So many people die very young. Others live out their normal life expectancy. And others, of course, live far, far past their life expectancy. In different parts of the world, we see it differently. In some parts of the world, the average age one can expect to live is only about 46 years of age due to war and disease. There are places in some of the third world countries now that have life expectancy have gone down from 55 to 50 to going toward 45 because of disease, AIDS, and wars, etc. In several of the countries in Europe and America, the average life expectancy is around 75 years plus. I am over 50 years old at this time of this writing. So if I make the average or live up to the average life expectancy, I can expect to live around 25 years or so more. However, or you know, perhaps a little longer, perhaps shorter. However, the reality is that most of my life is over. Therefore, let me reflect on my failures, my challenges, my accomplishments, as well as the ultimate goals that I'm trying to strive for. After all, I will die soon, so I must be clear about my status. I've always prayed and cried out for guides, teachers, mentors. As I look back, it seems that there was never a time that I was not having powerful mentorship. Every one of my mentors was extremely tolerant and valuable, even though I was very demanding and ungrateful. I often challenged and I doubted them. Sometimes I secretly compared them with each other, often accepting mainly those things that I wanted to hear or wanted to believe. I expertly took credit for myself what was fully all due to their mercy. But most unfortunately, I never fully shared to any of them how much I appreciated their wonderful guidance, I was not sufficiently selfless, humble, or brave. I have been, as far as long as I can remember, a seeker of knowledge and truth. Even today, I have so many, many, many books. Yesterday, I was doing inventory. And I had bought a few more shelves to put so many more books and so many things. Every place where I reside, I have so many books. I'm always reading, trying to understand everything. Now I know almost everything that I ever wanted to know. Whatever I wanted to know, I feel pretty much I know now. But most things I have forgotten or really do not actually understand. In other words, I have heard and read so much. I was thinking the last few days that anything that I ever wanted to know, I know now. In general. You know the basics. But what do I really understand? You know, and realize I don't really understand so much. But I have tried to possess knowledge and truth through my mind and intelligence. But I have mainly acquired information and data while connecting with knowledge, wisdom, and truth. I've been connecting with those things superficially. My problem is that I am not sufficiently selfless, humble, or brave. Being a very restless person, I was very eager to travel far and wide. I have traveled to every continent and to most countries in the world. I spent so much money in expensive air flights. I'm just preparing now in a week or so to come back from Chicago to go to Croatia and Vienna and Switzerland and Munich and England. I was just thinking of the amount of expense for all these trips. It is very expensive. $1,000, $1,000, $100,000. I met thousands of wonderful people, gave thousands of classes, attended many seminars, workshops, and festivals. So I'll be doing a major workshop for about a week, about 800, 900 devotees in Croatia in a couple of days, in a week or two. Even though my disciples, God brothers, God sisters, and others were so accommodating and kind to me, I usually take them for granted. My problem is that I am not sufficiently humble, some selfless, humble, and brave. I love culture and entertainment. In bhakti yoga, there are always some scholars, rites of passages, anniversaries, festivals, dancing, singing, feasting. Every day is like, or can be, a festival. Many of these wonderful events I do not participate in, or when I do sometimes, I am not fully present. We all know that secret. Sometimes being even in class, or being in a festival, or being with people, but not really being fully present. We do it out of duty. We do it because others are doing it. We do it because it's something that we're supposed to do. But often we are not fully present. So we miss some of the opportunity of absorption that can come from that wonderful opportunity. Sometimes I wonder why I do not absorb myself more fully in this wonderful culture of bhakti. Then I realize, once again, it is because I'm not sufficiently selfless, humble, and brave. Families are very important. They are microcosms of the nation and of the international community. I have a large biological family and a very sizable international spiritual family. Both of my families love me dearly. They often inconvenience themselves and make sacrifices on my behalf. But how do I reciprocate? Sometimes sometimes not at all. And other times only in a utilitarian way. Many times people are very expert in doing things, but their motives are not so pure. Their motives are mainly about arranging for external things to happen. So they're more about external productivity than conscious raising, conscious development. We all have to look at ourselves sometimes to see where's an action really coming from, what level of consciousness. Once again, I'm confronted with the same problem. I'm not sufficiently selfless, humble, or brave. Anyone who flatters me can get me to do almost anything. I love to be praised, congratulated, respected, etc. However, if someone criticizes me or ignores me, I feel hurt and insulted, and even angry. This is where we have to really address false ego. When people say nice things to us, we become very excited. When people ignore us, criticize or challenge us, do we become sad, depressed, angry? And so, we got a lot of ego to deal with. Because if we're really doing something in genuine sense, we are happy whether the whole world recognizes us or not. And when we get criticized, we can become even more excited because we're thinking, here this person is helping me to see how to improve. Look at all of yourselves and think about that. Think about the last time somebody ignored you, criticized you, challenged your existence or challenged something you said or did. What was going on in your consciousness? Were you ready to embrace that and to use it? Krishna's mercy? Were you in the spirit of Dasu Dasano Dasu Tanya Seven Seven of the Servant and thanking that person for making such an offering? Or did you feel angry? Did you feel depressed? Did you feel insulted? Did you think about how to retaliate? Did you just start looking at that person's faults and think how better you are or what right that person has to offer you, to criticize you, to ignore you? We have to look close because we're all going to die soon, even if we live to be 100 years. And we all have to look at our status. And our status means what we are thinking and doing every day, every interaction. So, what goes on? Only we know. We have to examine ourselves and hopefully have the conviction to do that and to be honest and truthful. And where we see that we are below mark, we should work on it. Because Krishna is particularly giving us an opportunity to see ourselves by the interaction of sadhu sangha. Saintly people interact specifically to draw out the best and the worst in each other. Saintly people interact to remind each other of the goal, hopefully by example first. Saintly people interact to be able to look closer at how they can synergistically be able to serve the Lord. Many people interact to see how they can come forth to help and how they can be able, of course, to honor Him. So, if someone criticizes me or ignores me, I feel hurt. That's attachment. Insulted and even angry. Sometimes I hold grudges or lament for months or for years. Sometimes even in the devotional community, people hold grudges. They just decide that I don't want to talk to that person. I don't want to serve with that person. I don't like that person. This has nothing to do with serious spiritual acceleration, but definitely is a part of contamination. A Vaishnava is not even one's enemy's enemy. Even if somebody chooses to be your enemy, if you honor that and reciprocate as their enemy, then that's a sign of great attachment to the duality. It's a sign of the ego being quite dominant. The ego surfaces in different ways when it comes up. We have to address it. Otherwise, it literally takes over. I'm interacting with so many spiritual communities, not only our own, but so many. And it's shocking to see people falling on their faces after giving most of their life to a spiritual commitment. And there are reasons for that. And it has a lot to do with people going on and on and on and not really looking and applying the spiritual acceleration to themselves honestly. And so Krishna, God is kind. He And so if we don't listen and respond one way, then he gives us more abrupt situations to help us to see what our actual status is. And so for many people, they don't really take notice until it is so obvious that they can't turn from it because they have been embarrassed. People, it's like you're walking in a dangerous area and you're being nonchalant. And so sometimes you don't take notice until you trip. Then once you trip and you fall, you get yourself dirty, you scar yourself, and then you realize this is a dangerous place to walk. But that's the hard way to learn, and it's also very precarious because sometimes when you get wounded, that wound doesn't quite heal so easily. Or sometimes when we get wounded, then we go to the other, we go to the opposite situation to try to bring about the healing. In other words, we take more shelter or more danger rather than of actual protection. As Hiranama was explaining the other day about people going from one extreme to the other. So then we decide to jump ship. And of course, one will, in most cases, still hold on to some credits based on what they have done. If they become so offensive, they lose those credits. But if somebody can become God conscious, then we should think, okay, I want to be one of those persons. I don't want to miss a chance for acceleration given there's opportunity. I don't want to take a back seat. I don't want mediocrity. I don't want to accept failure. But I want to be a high achiever, which means that I stop trying to do based on my own mind and intelligence only. I let a higher intelligence take over me. I get rid of this false self that is following me every day, letting me know it's around, and I keep denying it, ignoring it, until it just chokes me. So I see people getting choked all over. I'm writing other leaders in other communities and other spiritual situations and addressing and trying to give some information, Sikhs and the New Agers and the monks and the Buddhists, because this is happening all over the planet now. People who've invested so much in their spiritual bank accounts, and they are having tremendous trouble, where they're beginning to question everything that they committed themselves to. This is how much the mental culture is affecting people. It's like it's being attacked, people's minds being seized by these tremendous negative influences that particularly started as we enter into this new millennium. Very inauspicious, so many of them lying. So there are combatants, there are fights everywhere. All kind of in-house fighting is going on. Again, those devotees who are assisting me with my email, they see, not one day has gone by practically since the beginning of this year that I haven't been dealing with some kind of messages on email about some conflict, some fight. On every level. It's amazing. I'm spending about 5 or 6 hours a day, you know, just addressing emails. And that's when we're moving pretty fast. Some days almost half the day. It's just a good amount of those people in distress. I had suicide issues dealing with the last week. I had people who've been married for 30 years breaking up, people who've been involved in the process for so long and wanting and thinking about maybe they made a mistake. Yes, you go through midlife crisis, you begin to question everything. Even if you weren't spiritual, you begin to question your past, looking at your present and wondering about your future. But then the real test takes place. Now, what do you do? After all, 50 years old, as I'm speaking about myself, most of your life is over. So the question is, what do you do with the last part of your life? And that question each person is asking himself. Many times, I have an opportunity to help someone preach or stand up for righteousness, integrity, and truth. I, however, wait for someone else to jump in. Or I rationalize that I am too busy and I have more important things to pursue. We look at ourselves and we might have to ask, are there times when we can make a difference in bringing forth more sense of character, integrity, principle, centeredness, righteousness, truthfulness, bringing forth a greater sense of divinity? Are there times when we distinctly have chance to make a difference, but we choose not to? Well, the Lord in the heart is taking notice. And the Lord in the heart has made that opportunity, given us that chance, and is taking notice how we used it. I have done so much. I have done this so much. I have learned to feel not guilty. Because often we want peace rather than service. So we look for the avenue that's going to be less imposing on ourselves, even though we may have the ability to make a difference. I have done this so much, I have learned to feel not guilty. For I have convinced myself that my lack of not acting, is noble, rather than an act of cowardice. If I was not so selfish and proud, surely I would access, the word is bravery. Krishna has said, he rewards each person as they surrender. Surrender means not that we think less of ourselves. Surrender doesn't mean that we have a lack of self-esteem. Surrender doesn't mean that one is to be docile. Surrender doesn't mean that one is to have some blind faith, be motivated by blind faith. Surrender does not mean that we think less of ourselves, but we think of ourselves less. By thinking of ourselves less and more of others, we can become selfless. And someone can say, okay, Swami, all these meditations, you're thinking about yourself. But I'm trying to write these in the spirit of thinking of myself to be a better servant for others. So we think about our issues, we think about ourselves, we think about problems in the spirit for service, then Krishna magic takes place, which is the next few stanzas. First class devotees are so appreciative of others and so eager to serve, they have very little time to worry so much about themselves. We worry about ourselves, we should be worrying about how we can be in a better position to serve. We worry that we don't have money, we worry about our health, we worry about our car, we worry about our house, we worry about our time. We should be worrying in the sense of, how can I be better in service to Guru and to Sadhu? How can I be in better service to the Supreme Lord? But if our worry is that we're worrying that I don't have money, and it stops there, I'm worrying that my health is bad, and it stops there, I'm worrying about my house, my car, my this or that, and it stops there, then we are going to get more to worry about and are going to bring more of the ego and the illusion and the confusion into our lives. So again, look at our worries and reflect on what level is it coming from. After all, we are going to die soon. So we must look at our status. Where are those worries really coming from? Is it stopping with just ahamamiti, my health, my plan, my money, my this, my that? Someone may say, but life is about trying to experience and trying to enjoy. Yes. And that's why we want to enjoy on the highest level by going beyond just the temporary sense gratification and the relative material culture. And so we want to access the culture of bhakti, but in most cases, people don't really want that. And that's why, at certain levels, they become stagnant. Or at certain levels, they find themselves in great bewilderment, because for many times, we have not dressed those subtle things that Guru and Krishna keeps bringing before us. This is why journaling and diving is very important. because it can help us to look a little closer at what is happening and what the trends in our lives. Or to what degree are we still dealing with the same kind of problem? Or to what degree are we still denying some of the issues? Or to what degree are we still having the same issues with this devotee, that devotee, with our services, etc.? As we look in such ways, then we can go deeper to analyze to see what is to be taken out. What is to be eliminated? What things, prashana, pina, pashati, what things we're seeing but perhaps not really seeing? What things we're hearing but perhaps not really hearing? And then we begin to realize, oh, Krishna all along has been there, and he all along has been hearing our prayers, but we have not been sufficiently hearing him. That's if somebody is telling you to do this, and you don't do it. Then they find another way how to communicate. So some of the difficulties that people are experiencing is Krishna giving us another way how he is communicating with us, since we are not hearing and accepting what he's making available. But they have to hear it sometimes in other ways. It can be very, very painful. And sometimes if we don't move out of that into another life, especially if we get into certain conditional patterns. Therefore, the physical, you know, people are really worried. This is a part of psychological processing and maturation. People have a fear of death. But really addressing their false ego is even a greater fear. Because so much of our identity is based on false conceptions. We have to come before the Lord as a beggar. So it's even more difficult than dealing with death of the physical body. Because the ego has been so much acculturated from not only this lifetime, but many other lifetimes. It's all part of our subtle existence. Every time there's death, then physical body is gone. Physical body, one lifetime, death. But the subtle body is going on, lifetime after lifetime, carrying the soul to another experience, another realm of duplicity, of enjoyment, of running away from the Lord. And so this fear of getting rid of the false ego is actually stronger and greater than even that of physical death. We know the fear that we have of physical death. And this is why spiritual life is so easy, but it's so difficult. Because this false ego cannot be addressed if we're approaching it myopically and with false conceptions and proper motives. Because we can't cheat the Lord. We can't cheat Krishna. We can't cheat God. And so this is an area that there will be categorical monitoring and reciprocation. So many things we can do socially, mentally, intellectually, and we can hype it. But when it comes to ego, false ego, we can't hype it. Because that is one of the major things we see that blocks us from our returning back to the Lord. One of the major issues that interferes with spiritual journey, spiritual service. And this is why we talk about these kind of issues and these kind of programs, because these are universal things that are stagnation for anyone who is striving spiritually. That we cannot approach God where we're still holding on to illusion and to cheating. Because false ego in one sense says, I don't want to have God or the kingdom of God really with God. Part of false ego says, I don't want to really pay the actual price. I deserve more even though I'm not ready to pay. False ego says that I am more than what I want people to accept that I'm more than what I really am. I want God to accept more than what I really am. False ego says, I want the maximum amount and I want to put in the minimum amount. So whatever minimum I have to do, I'll do. But I want maximally to come to me. And so that, driving and feeding, or even trying to ingratiate the Lord. So this is how serious it is. So a few more things here. So Krishna has revealed each person as they surrender, he rewards accordingly. Surrender means not to think less of ourselves, but to think of ourselves less. By thinking of ourselves less, it doesn't mean just the thinking, it means where's really coming from. Thinking of yourself, but in relationship to being a better servant, wonderful, necessary. First class devotees are so appreciative of others and so eager to serve, they have very little time to worry about themselves. They're not in denial. They're not caught up in material manifestation. But they're realizing who their real self is and what the real needs of the self. Krishna noticed such a devotee. He takes away their personal problem. This is the Krishna magic. If we have problems and we think less of ourselves but more of others, then Krishna will intervene and will work on our own issues. We'll take away our own problems. The personal problems of each a devotee, so that devotee can continue to serve others nicely. Krishna also, he carries to such devotees what they are lacking, and he maintains nicely what they have. Being humble is another aspect of surrender. To be humble means to allow room for Radha and Krishna's love and sweetness and greatness to come through. We're not humble. Divine couple is trying to come through. God is trying to give us, trying to nourish us, trying to protect us, trying to share and give love. But ego closes the door. So being humble means open up the door and letting that love come to you. Being humble is to recognize the importance of the great legacy left by the Vaishnava Acharyas. Being humble, see, when we realize what has been passed down to us and really embrace and accept that, we're in awe to try to live up to it and to experience it and to keep it sacred. Being humble is to worship and scrutinizingly study the scriptures. Seeing the scriptures are literal incarnation of God. Being humble is to rejoice when others are successful and to feel their pain when they have setbacks. You look and see. Somebody is in pain. Are we ignoring it? Considering it was not me. Somebody successful. Are we as happy or more happy about their success? Or do we just go back into our normal mindset? We're thinking about our failure, success, happiness, lacking, shortcomings, etc. Being brave, being humble is to rejoice when others are successful and to feel their pain when they have said that. Being brave, remember this, selfless, humble, and brave. We talked about humility, and we're talking all along about selflessness, and now we're ending looking at perception of being brave. Not being brave to act foolishly, or to take shelter of unhealthy things. Being brave is one of the most important aspects of surrender. One cannot be transcendentally brave without first being selfless and humble. I was thinking while Prabhupada mentioned about brave. If you're not selfless and you're not humble, there's no question of being transcendentally brave. One cannot be transcendently brave without being first selfless and humble. If one is not selfless and humble, one will not value others sufficiently. Reflect on it. And will therefore mainly act for one's own so-called welfare. When there is proper selflessness and humility, the devotees will eagerly become the servant of others. Such devotees will eagerly become the servant of others. and be eager, bold about it. A selfless, humble devotee is brave, for he or she will stand only behind truth and integrity, even if they are in the minority, or even if they must stand alone. The brave devotee is determined to represent the acharyas with his best or her best offerings. The brave devotee is a spiritual warrior who fights on the battlefield of consciousness. Realizing the main battle is the battlefield of consciousness. With weapons of compassion, truth, and love. The brave devotee monitors his actions and is guided by Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. By spiritual master, by saints, by scripture. And this is why he proceeds with great confidence and compassion. Not that he's brave foolishly, but because checking in, Sadhu, Shastra, and Guru, then one launches ahead with great zeal, avidity, eagerness, boldness, because one is still lovingly protected and guided and is ready to act according to whatever the call of duty. So last, I must die soon. When I look at my present status, I realize I'm lacking in all these three areas: selflessness, humility, and bravery. I do not have much time to transform my character. Remember, death comes soon. Where's the time? I have already wasted too many years by being so ungrateful. My obstacles are very clear to me now. I must become truly selfless, humble, and brave. But even knowing what I must develop and work on, it is a tremendous task. For my false ego also knows and has already made arrangements to try to break each of my endeavors. So how will I be able to fully help myself to surrender when I am my own greatest enemy? How will I help myself when I'm my greatest enemy? How will I help myself when I'm my greatest illusion? When I'm the greatest aspect responsible for my incarceration? How can I help myself when I am expertly finding ways to rationalize my deviation? How can I help myself when I'm finding so many ways to justify not becoming more devotional, more serious? How can I help myself when I'm allowing my external self to become so angry, become so hurt, when things do not go my way? How can I help myself when I am so eager to respond to my false self, to flattery, to ingratiation? How can I help myself when I don't think the help is there? How can I help myself when I become comfortable in being a cheater? How can I help myself when my faith is very weak about what is to be attainable? How can I help myself when I doubt Krishna's real mercy and concern for me? So even knowing what I must develop and work on is a tremendous task. But my false ego also knows and has already made arrangements to try to break each of my endeavors. So how will I be able to fully help myself to surrender when I am my own greatest enemy? I have only a little time left to become selfless, humble, and brave. But my false ego laughs and says, it is already too late. After all, You have tried this many times before, and you have failed. But maybe it is not too late. Perhaps, beloved, you can help me this time. Hare Krishna. So I am writing these kind of things for specific purposes. First, for self-purification, but I'm writing because this is a very serious time in the devotional community. It is a very serious time for spirituals on this planet, and most people are being a disappointment. Now, why do I say like that? Maybe that's ego. Or maybe it's because of being in attention to what is going on. Maybe it's because of being able to scrutinize what is happening. And maybe it's because of wanting to make a difference. Hopefully, all of those things are there. You decide. Look at yourself and make evaluation of where things are coming from. What level is it coming from? Your real self, your real desires connected with Guru and Krishna? Or to what degree is it coming from relative and transitory considerations? Krishna will help us all. Because if it's coming from the wrong place, we will see ourselves failing again and again in similar areas. And if we don't begin to pass in those areas, we will lose faith and we'll start turning back to security based on things that we used to do that gave us a little pleasure. If we are not addressing the false ego sufficiently, we will find ourselves so constantly unhappy because the false ego chokes Krishna and Radha's love from coming through. When that love comes through, regardless to whatever hell is going on, we feel happy because the transcendental is never just subservient to the material. And we're becoming too depressed, too sad, we're losing faith, losing desire to chant around nicely, losing desire to read, losing desire to honor Vaishnava. Something's going on. We come to a point that we start questioning our whole existence after 25, 30 years, 10 years, whatever. Then that is good, because that means, oh, here's a chance to grow if we're ready to be honest. And if not, then the false self will jump right in and we will look at all kind of reasons why not to address the issue. We will point at every other person, at everything, but we will not point to ourselves. And so everything really comes down a lot to how much we really have faith in Krishna's mercy. And then it determines how much we accept it. So maybe there's a few questions or comments you can try to take. Does being selfless, humble, and brave. We can all reflect on that in different ways. There are many, many ways we can look closer at our scriptures to analyze these things. What is selflessness? What is humility? What does it really mean to be brave? We'll see in all of our great acharyas those qualities. Abhaya, we see Prabhupada's name, emphasizing fearlessness. And we see how any true saints, they're never just eager to be a part of normality. They're not interested in going along with whatever's comfortable. But they are literally spiritual revolutionaries. Because of selflessness, humility, and then of course they're bold because of it. So this false ego, looking that we made, not we made it, looking that we all of us need the body from whatever, however long we live, whatever part of the world we're in, whatever gender we're in, we're going to lose it. Even 100 years, 50 years, 75 years is a short time. And if we've lived most of our life already, you look and think, okay, what is my status? What do I do with these 2 years I have? Or as I was writing, so the day I die, now, What do I do? What things are important? What things need to be said? What things need to be changed? What things need to be worked on? Anyone? Any questions or comments?
And when you say that, I think a lot about, like, you know, the battle of Kurukshetra and Yudhisthira and Bhima. And, you know, it seems like there's always this combination. Or I think, and I was just reading the other day about Parashuram, you know, and, you know, he went and he killed the Kshatriya race 21 times. You know, you want to talk about, like, real trying times, you know. And, you know, then the battle of Kurukshetra was such a, you know, incredible, like, you know, momentous event. And then there's always seems to be this combination. For example, often in Krishna's pastimes, you'll see there's always this moment where Krishna is just totally covered by arrows, and it seems like there is no hope. And then what's amazing about Krishna is how he breaks out, and on the battlefield you can see that, you know, like the darkest hours always just before the dawn or something like that. So I was just thinking about that dawn, when we go here. And it seems dark in a lot of ways, but compared to, like, the battle of Kurukshetra, it doesn't seem very dark. Or you can read in our scriptures, in other histories of when Krishna appeared, and it doesn't seem so dark. Sometimes I think it's not so dark, it just, especially here in America, it's just incredibly boring, kind of like this Pax Americana, you know, self-satisfied materialism that's just driving everybody's crazy, so like, surely because there's no ecstasy in it. So, anyway,
these are good observations. Before the day, you know, there is the night. So after the night, you see the day. Whether it's, you know, Brahma's night, or whether it's the night in a particular universe, particular planet, particular part of the world, particular city. The night is there, and then there is day. When we look closer at this, the degree of things that's happening, it's pretty intense. If we look at one third of the world possibly being affected, you know, by AIDS. I mean, there are certain places now where the whole economy, the education, the health, culture, everything is being affected, you know, by AIDS. The increase in orphans. Now, in some places in the world, they have to train 5 teachers to get 2. So by the time the teachers are trained and ready to function, they've got AIDS. You know, one thing after another is being affected. You look at the conflict that's going on now, you know, between part of the Arab world and Israel, India and Pakistan. We look at, I was just talking with, you know, I've been giving discussions about depression. And Radha Sundari called me the other day and she said, you know, my daughter works in Borders, one of the big Borders in Michigan. She said, do you know the number one category of books that's being taken out now? Borders is one of the biggest bookshops, you know, in America, one of the biggest in the world. And the number one category is books on depression. I mean, people are really struggling identity. And this is all types of people. The amount of suicide in depression is increasing in so many ways. So there is a lot of issues, you know. I mean, when you see that there are certain schools now in America where 25% of the kids, you know, are taking ventolin and getting more and more drugged up. The number of people, even the number of devotees who are on medication, it's pretty intense. So there's, and then go on. And I do a whole thing with this. I do 5 chapters in my Spiritual Warrior 3 just talking nationally, internationally about the tremendous problems. Just spelling them out, you know, really, really detailed, that it is a very, very difficult term. I mean, we asked you in the room, you know, how many devotees are finding that in the last, you know, 6-7 months, that they've been really, really challenged? You know, you raise your hand, you can go that way. You see? majority of the voters did. And if we did that in one project after another, it was fine. I mean, we all have different times when things are a little worse than other times. But there are certain times when there's just kind of a consistent challenge, you know, that's going on. I mean, you know, I'm a very people's person. I talk very open, whatever I feel. You know, I've had several, you know, people who've been in the movement for 30 years, significant others, and say that in the last couple of months, they never felt so challenging in their whole Krishna consciousness. And I tell them, welcome. You're not alone. It's a very serious thing. Which means it's a time to grow. Any other questions? Yes. Yeah.
You were speaking so nicely about dismantling the necessity to dismantle the false identity throughout your class. And I was thinking how, and we can look back, look and see how the possibility of the false identity becoming institutionalized. Yet at the same, simultaneously we understand the necessity to dismantle false identity. So in the case where the false identity has become institutionalized, and then we actually see and experience that leaders or so many people that we have looked up to have actually fallen. And often we can see, is this a cause? In other words, rather than using the process of bhakti yoga to dismantle the false identity, the institution itself seems to have supported the building of false identity. So when these kind of things happen, is this not a blessing?
Yes, institutions very often, you know, maintain and propagate illusions. And institutions can do many, many unhealthy things. But institutions is the aggregate of also of individuals. So when you have too many individuals who are deviant, or too many individuals who are letting too much the false ego become dominant, then you start noticing institutional structures falling apart. And that is actually a blessing in many ways. Because when you get a headache, you get a fever, you get diarrhea, it's actually a blessing because it lets you know that something has to be done with the body. Let you realize that there is some intrusion in the body, some germs, some imbalance, some, you know, disease. And so it sends a message to you, you know, to work on it, to do something. But sometimes the disease is there and one doesn't really recognize it until, you know, there's death or near death. So yes, these are issues, you know, genuine issues. Any other questions? See, sometimes the institutional false ego is even harder to deal with because it's easier to, you know, to hide behind dogma, institutional dogma. And it's easier to pretend to be a company man when one is not genuinely a company man. Or it's easy to get distracted in, circuitous or tangential issues and miss the real issue. Sometimes institutions, the problem is there. And then people go searching and they go and they want to do a band-aid, you know, kind of solution. So they look for and put attention on issues, but not the real genuine issues, the more symptoms. So that can happen, you know. This is happening with individuals. The institutions have more facilities and more variables and more people, then it means also more chance to hide their growth, you know, to project. Institutions, anybody institution. Ours, anyone else institution, is dangerous. Just as they're powerful, they're also dangerous. Anyone who doesn't think the institution is dangerous can be in trouble. Because either means they can be a blind follower, or they are too much into just the rule of law, without understanding the, you know, the spirit of the law. Any other questions or comments?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Gurudev. I'm sure every devotee here wants to make a difference for Srila Prabhupada and for Krishna. You were speaking about being selfless and learning to be humble and trying to be fearless and brave. As we're trying to become spiritual warriors, how, when the mind rationalizes our deviations, how do we be compassionate towards ourselves?
Just like saying, someone knows they shouldn't smoke, but they smoke. You know, they shouldn't eat too much sugar, but they take too much sugar. You know, they're diabetic. They know they shouldn't gamble, but they gamble. So how does such a person become compassionate toward themselves? See, for many people, it's very difficult, because from day one, they haven't understood compassion. They haven't felt it, they haven't experienced it. Even on the most basic level. And this is one of the reasons why sometimes it's more difficult for us in counseling people. Just like, give an example. In the Catholic Church, Prabhupada said we should take some examples from the Catholic Church. He told us like that, you know, in some areas. The Catholic Church, with all of their problems, and they have a whole lot, so many, even more than we have, because they're bigger than we are also. But they have a basic understanding that a person who's going to oversee other people's lives, they have to have some serious training. So the person gets trained up in pastoral care, the person goes under a different type of apprenticeship, and maybe 5 or 6 years before they even, you know, can posit that they're going to be in a certain order. Just like taking, for example, a psychiatrist. A psychiatrist is supposed to know whether a person's illness is biological or whether it's psychological. Certain illnesses are just due to the physicality, it's physiological problems. And some other may be due to social psychological. So, as spiritualists, we have to deal with blocks based on physicality, based on psychological or social, as well as based on spiritual. And they're not always the same. If we are deep enough spiritually, we can resolve any block. But often, to be deep enough, we have to deal with certain psychological and social blocks. So sometimes we have a big, I'll give an example. Sometimes we have a tremendous fear of surrender and commitment, because we're carrying patterns that we had alcoholic parents, and we weren't able to really feel secure and protected by authority. And because of that, we're trying to be spiritual, but we're carrying a major aspect of our consciousness where it's very hard for us to really to accept shelter. Because what we have tried, it wasn't there. And the wounds and the pains are following us in our makeup. And so it may be a little harder for that kind of person to embrace a shelter and take shelter and embrace authority because of it. So we can just tell the person, you chant Hare Krishna, you'll be okay. And yes, that is there, and that works. But if the person is having so many things that's causing him not to chant Hare Krishna seriously, then he also has to be addressed. And so therefore we have, as devotees, we have philosophy and we have a lifestyle, how to follow that philosophy. Both things have to be taken care of in certain ways. So someone trying to be kind to themselves, merciful to themselves, when the basic pattern of their consciousness is destructive, it's going to be very hard. It's going to be hard for them. Prabhupada did not have to address all of this. Why? Why should he? He came right from the spiritual world. It's like he didn't have to tell us all the details of how to distribute books. He wanted the books and he wanted us to do it. He didn't tell us all the details of every detail of how to raise our children, how to raise our families, how to build communities. He gave us the basic, you know, boundaries and the patterns. He was, you know, he did. And so we have to accept that and use it. And then we have to look again at time, place, and circumstance. What is to be done? And that becomes even more and more difficult where there's false ego. We'll make a mistake again, 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 and we'll deny it. We'll say everything is okay. Any other question? Where there is selflessness and humility, then so many connections will fall in place. It has a lot to do with what we discussed many times. A Prabhupada himself says, in the mode of goodness, one knows what to do. But if ego is too strong, he will be stuck in ignorance and passion. It become harder to know what is to be done. Especially with ourselves. Because we keep chanting and keep following to some extent, then the process will be working on us. But whether it works in the way that we have to make ourselves suffer, that sometimes is the case. There are times when we really don't learn until the suffering gets so heavy. It's like with alcoholics, sometimes one doesn't really take it seriously, they fall rock bottom. And then when they fall so to the bottom, then you have to start looking up and really addressing the issue. So that sometimes Krishna has to just kind of take away. You know, we become so ungrateful, we don't deal with our issues sufficiently, so the time that Krishna just starts taking away. Until we are at a point where we have to look. Okay. We have certain problems, we make those big problems and we don't address it. And then Krishna just takes away, then we have real problems. So the person is taking alcohol and they're in denial. And then it gets to a point that they lost their job, they lost their house, they lost their friends, and now they're almost homeless. And then they realize, I really gotta work on this. But to have to make a change on that level, it's really difficult because now one is so bereft of so many things. Any last questions? Yes. Mm-hmm.
You were speaking about seeing our activities, where they're coming from. So is there already a knowingness within all of us about the false ego and the real ego? Because you're speaking to devotees, aspiring devotees, who know something about the false ego.
The soul knows everything. Our real identity, our real self, it knows everything. We, ourselves, real self, knows everything. It's a false self. That's bringing in the screen, the ambiguity, nebulousness. The soul is saturated in anavigraha. All the knowledge is there. We know within us exactly what is to be worked on, what the needs are. But the question is, are we ready? How much are we ready to, you know, to honor it? And that is a difficulty, because material life is an arena for the drama. So we get too much into the drama, we start accepting and believing, identifying with the drama. Like some people, they can lie and lie and lie and lie and lie so much that they start believing it. Become a part of, you know, they actually accept it, you know, they lie so much. Or we can rationalize something to such an extent that we're totally convinced, you know. Or we can tolerate something to such an extent that we don't see it anymore. Like some people can have such a, as we were talking earlier about, you know, being clean. People can just tolerate it so much that they don't even see. The house is like so unclean. Just become a part of it. So certain things become a part of us. And if there's not sufficient humility, selflessness, we won't be able to see it. And we say, well, why don't God just make it happen? Why don't He just remove it? He's ready to do that. But we bring it back or we hold on to it. So we'll stop now, it's getting a little late. So just reflect selflessness, humility, the idea of being selfless, humble, and brave. Very powerful and free words and free conceptions. It really can draw more attention to the false ego. It reminds us that whatever we are and however great we become or whatever plans we have, that overnight they not only can change, but at some point they will change. At the end of the day, we have to look and think, okay, this person got weak, this person fell, and this person in trouble. Is it just that those persons weren't very serious? Is it just that they weren't favored by Krishna? No. Somebody gets the flu, somebody gets a cold, somebody gets disease. You look and think, oh, this person is sick, that person is sick. It means disease is in the atmosphere, germs in the atmosphere. It means people can catch the disease. You, I can catch the disease. And so when we see these things, we should realize, oh, this can also happen to me. Or maybe this has already happened, or it is happening to me, and I'm not identifying and noticing it. And so, as we take inventory, then we can weed out some of these things sometimes before they settle in too much. Or we can be able to avoid some of it before it comes upon us. And then whatever happens around us, okay, we'll still find certain happiness, certain zeal, zealousness, and even more conviction, not less. We won't have put in so much and then start backsliding. We'll start finding ways to justify. Now, no deviating. We won't be in relationship for so many years and then decide, oh, let me go for my other boyfriend, girlfriend, or this or that. Maybe there's some weeds there that have to be addressed. We won't be now questioning, are these scriptures really real? In the Prabhupada, did he make mistakes? We won't start questioning such things because we'll be able to have processed things genuinely that our realizations and our experiences will constantly confirm what we are reading. This Khan found the charge of His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Sri Prabhupada C.C. Radha Damodar Radha Kalachandri Gornitai Ki. Yes.